New American is pleased to interview Dr. Joseph Farrow, author and super genius. Patristics expert and Oxford-educated historian, he runs the groundbreaking website Giza Death Star. His news and views from the Nefarian podcast is well worth seeing if you want to stay informed. Today, he's here to talk to us about his book, The Nazi International. Dr. Farrow, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Daniel.
Hey, so I wanted to ask you, now that I have you on here, and I'm a huge fan of yours, as everybody knows, I was reading a book by Ed Conway. He wrote a book called The Summit about the Bretton Woods situation, and he talked about the German finance minister, Walter Funk, and how Walter Funk coined the term New World Order. And Ed Conway, there's a quote here that I wanted to share with you. Mm-hmm. The quote is, in November, Harold Nicholson sent Keynes an account of Funk's plan and asked him to discredit it. Rather predictably, the attempt to force Keynes to sing from a prearranged song sheet backfired. In my opinion, about three quarters of the passages quoted from the German broadcast would be quite excellent if the name of Great Britain were substituted for Germany or the Axis, as the case may be, he wrote back. If Funk's plan is taken at face value, it is excellent and just what we ourselves should be thinking. So what were your thoughts about John Maynard Keynes, the guy who was doing the Bretton Woods post-World War II system, and him singing the praises of the Walter Funk Nazi post-war system?
Keynes would sing the praises of Walter Funk, and what he's referring to, I actually discuss at some length in another one of my books on the Nazi International that I call The Third Way, Corporate Fascism, the European Union and the Nazi International. In 1942, Walter Funk, who was the Reich Economics and Finance Minister at the time, and incidentally in charge of the Reichsbank, okay? Walter Funk sponsored, along with, here it comes, folks, IG Farben, sponsored a study called Weltraum Kartell, okay? And in German, that means World Space Cartel. And what this document was, it was actually a book, but that they published in 1942 at the height of World War II. And you had all sorts of experts contributing to this document. What the document was basically a map, a template for the European Union. You can read this document and compare the structure of the European Union and see amazing parallels. So in other words, Funk was the ultimate mercantilist Keynesian. Mm-hmm. In other words, he's designing a European Union where you have amalgamation of patent law, that you have large, and I mean, you know, if you're thinking of IG Farben, you're thinking of an enormous corporation with enormous amounts of power. You're looking at the organization of the European Union on the basis of cartels, of large corporations. Mm-hmm. Well, this is right up John Maynard Keynes' alley, because as part of Funk's scheme, you had a central administration for basically a fiat currency run finance system.
Yep.
And you know, this is Bretton Woods. You know, let's remember that the people involved in Bretton Woods are people like Harry Dexter White and people like this that end up being on the Venona transcripts as communist agents of influence. So, you know, this is all one big socialist love fest. We got Nazis, we got communists. You
know? Yeah, no, just for our audience so that they understand, the Bretton Woods system is the post-World War II financial system, right, that was set up, and it was set up chiefly by John Maynard Keynes from England and Harry Dexter White from the United States Treasury. And White was later implicated for being, yep, a communist. He was sending secrets back to the Soviet Soviets. And and Keynes, of course, was an open socialist. So you had two, yeah, socialists, socialists slash communists, who were creating the post-World War II system. And Keynes wanted to, very explicitly, he wanted to disempower the United States, and he wanted, mm-hmm, to create, like, he wanted to shift all the power to global institutions like the World Bank, and he wanted to create a global world currency called Bancor, was one of the early, yep, terms for it. But yeah, but a lot of his thinking was based on Walter Funk, on the Nazi party. And I wanted to, you mentioned IG Farben, and I wanted to touch on something. I was showing my boy, we were looking at a book on economics, And one of the things we were looking at was chemistry and the rise of chemistry. And so our modern system, our modern capitalist system was based on the Netherlands and England creating the first textile industry. So they were creating shirts and blankets and stuff. And then Germany created the first synthetic dye, and they created the synthetic purple. And so the guy who created the synthetic purple to go with the textile industry, so it was an adjunct to the textile industry, he got fabulously rich. And this led to Germany's chemical industry, to IG Farben, and then to the pharmaceutical industry. And so Germany was making bank on all of these innovations, these technical innovations. So when Joseph earlier said that these were cartels, economic cartels, you know, this is what he's referring to. So go ahead, Joseph, cut me off. I'm talking.
No, I was done. I had made my point, but it's important to go back and look at Funk from one other perspective. And that is that you have in the proposals that were part of this 1942 IG Farben Nazi document, you have two other things, and that's the amalgamation of patent law through regulatory bureaucratic process. In other words, not through legislation. Okay. So in other words, you're creating a bureaucratic state that is going literally to legislate via regulation. And then the second thing you'll have to notice is they create, or they talk about what essentially is going to become the exchange rate mechanism, if you remember that intermediate step from the Deutschmark to the euro. Because the exchange rate mechanism was basically a mechanism where the currencies of smaller nations were pegged to the Deutschmark. So in other words, the Dutch guilder, the Austrian shilling, the Danish kroner, prior to the emergence of the euro as a unit of currency, these currencies were all pegged to the Deutschmark. And the Bundesbank would allow the currency rates to fluctuate within certain narrow limits and then step in if those currencies started to fluctuate outside of it. And that mechanism then incorporated the French franc and became the euro. Okay. So in other words, all of this, what I'm telling people is this whole cartel regulatory fiat finance system is a Nazi plan. Like it or not.
Yeah, that's a good point. I wanted to touch on something too, because lest we get too mired in like nation states and that concept. You know, of course, there's who's the gentleman from the Hoover Institute, Anthony Sutton, and he does the, you know, Bolshevik and the Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and Hitler, and Wall Street and FDR. He does this trilogy, and he just shows how the Atlanticist banking grid is creating color revolutions, all from one building in Broad Street. Can't remember the address. It was like 234 Broad Street. And so they had done the Panama Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, the Mexican Revolution in 1914, the Russian Revolution in 1917, all from one building. And this leads me into a question. And I'm not as well read as you, obviously, no one is, especially on this subject. But I was reading Pepe Escobar, the Brazilian journalist, and Pepe Escobar was talking about events that are happening now, where the New Silk Road, China wants to build this railway all across Central Asia into Europe. And if this happens, all that trade will be traveling over land and not overseas. So the United States will lose trillions in terms of tariffs. It would greatly enfeeble our military and our treasury. But this concept, Pepe Escobar says that the reason why the current Ukraine crisis is happening with neo-Nazis is to basically stop a friendship between Germany, Russia, and China. Because if that happens, the English and the American system kind of goes down. And now this is my question. I was reading this book, this white paper, actually, The Geographical Pivot of History by Sir Halford
McKinder. Yeah,
and so in 1904, he talks about how Russia, if Russia industrializes, if it's allowed to industrialize, the geopolitical center of the world will shift from the Atlantic into Central Asia. They have two-thirds of global population. And so in 1904, he was saying, this can't be allowed to happen. You can't allow Germany, Russia, and China to unite, because then it becomes Eurasia and they become powerful. And so my question is this, like my whole life, I've been thinking of Hitler as this organic thing that happened in World War II. But when you look at it in retrospect, and especially in light of current events, it looks like they created, just like they're creating now, like a tension on that border between Europe and Russia to basically mm-hmm. break that up. And mm-hmm. so Hitler, who was most people might not know this, and Hitler even admits this, that he was originally an agent. He was in military intelligence, and he was actually mm-hmm. spying for the government. And Hitler got lots of financing from the West and everything. So was Hitler, in your estimation, like possibly, you know, working in a weird kind of way with that Atlanticist grid to ensure that the Eurasia doesn't happen?
No. You've packed a lot of stuff into that question. So let me try and unpack it. And this is going to take a while. Let's look at Mackinder, first of all. Mm-hmm. Halford Mackinder is basically the geopolitical textbook for the Anglosphere, for the Anglo-American Atlanticist global alliance, all right? And Mackinder basically says what you said, that if Russia's allowed to industrialize, this shifts the geopolitical center of the world from the Atlantic powers to the Eurasian landmass. In other words, from naval powers to land powers, okay? But he also doesn't say this in a vacuum. He's got reasons that he's saying this. He's saying it because at that point in time, when he wrote that book, Russia was just finishing up the Trans-Siberian Railway. And what Mackinder is really concerned about is the ability of emerging technologies of railroads, and now add to that aircraft, to stitch together that big landmass without the necessity of navies. And it would be a much more difficult thing to interdict supply lines if you have a land-based power, all right? The third thing he said was, whoever controls the world island controls the world. Now, world island in Mackinder has two meanings, and most people don't get this. The term world island refers to that grand Eurasian African landmass, but it also refers to the more or less geographic center of those three continents, which is in Palestine.
Interesting.
So he has two understandings of world islands. So whoever controls the world island controls the world. Whoever controls the European Eurasian heartland, which is that big region that we're now embroiled in, the Eastern European powers and Western European Russia and the Ukraine. Okay, that's the region that he means as the heartland. Whoever controls the heartland, he says, controls the world island. And whoever controls Berlin controls the heartland. Mm-hmm. So in other words, in Mackinder's thinking, what you cannot permit is a Russo-German alliance. You cannot permit all of that technology in Germany to be allied with all of those natural resources in Russia.
Yes.
And to create a market out of that region, because if that happens, the center of gravity, which has been based on the sea-based powers for the last two millennia, mm-hmm. shifts dramatically to Asia. So in Mackinder's thinking, in that British geopolitical Bible's thinking, you cannot permit an alliance of Germany and Russia. Now, enter Hitler. Hitler is in his own way, accidentally playing into the Anglosphere hands. But Hitler, if you look at the 1942 study and go back to German World War I war aims, what Hitler is really doing is he's pursuing what Germany announced its war aims were in World War I. That is to say, create a European Union with Germany at the center, and with the Reichsmark as basically the European reserve currency, and enter an alliance with Russia. This is what they want to prevent. Mm-hmm. So Hitler basically is fulfilling the war aims of World War I Germany. But the change has been that during the 1920s, what happened? Well, you had the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and then you had that period under Lenin and Stalin of the four-year plans and the dramatically rapid industrialization of Russia. Russia in World War I was not an industrial power. That's why Germany and Austria-Hungary beat the daylights out of Russia. In World War II, the shoe's on the other foot. Russia is now an industrial power, and it's much more difficult for Germany to defeat it. So you're dealing with a long-term thing here. I don't think that Hitler is a secret agent for the British. I do think inadvertently he manages to serve British interests. Mm-hmm. But if he is, let me put it, sum it up this way. If he is a secret agent for the British, he's being used as a cat's paw to try and prevent Russia from dominating that whole Eurasian region. And of course, he fails.
Well, one of the things that it reminded me reading Mackinder was, and somebody just recently said this too in an article, I can't remember who, that they can't allow Russia to, as you said, you know, be like an industrialized first world nation. And so they've done everything to sabotage that. And so,
well, when you you know, the bad news is they are.
So, well, when you look at, Bismarck said that, like in the 19th century, he said the two great powers that are going to emerge are the United States and Russia based on their geography and based on their natural resources. Mm-hmm. And he was right. And mm-hmm. so one of those was allowed to industrialize. But initially the United States, one of the reasons for the American Revolution was that we wanted to industrialize and Great Britain wanted to keep us a feudal plantation colony that just kept giving us the raw materials for their textile industry. So they would do the high tech textile stuff. They'd get lots of money for that. We would be the poorer, you know, industrial backwater. And that was one of the big tensions. William Pitt said in 1770, the United States or America shall not be allowed to make so much as a horseshoe nail. And they actually created the navigation laws, the Navigation Acts to keep out materials that would allow us to make factories. And we rebel against them. We industrialize. Boom. We take over the world. Now I'm looking at Russia, which had that exact same capacity. If you read Anthony Sutton, he said that they were absolutely, he said they couldn't manufacture a ham sandwich. He said almost everything that they did was Western companies going in and actually doing their five-year plans. And so when you look at what they did with Russia, there were two nationalists. There was the Kerensky for good, better or worse. And then there was Kolchak, who was the general who controlled like 3/4 of Russia. And Wall Street said, we want neither of these men to be in power because they're nationalists. They will not loot their country. They're not going to hurt their own country. So they bring in two internationalists, Trotsky and Lenin, who treat their comments about Slavs are reprehensible.
Well, they're reprehensible, but let's remember something that happens. Yeah, they bring in these people, but here's where that analysis, I think, again, and I cover this in the third way. In 1922, the two pariah nations of Europe do an end run around this Western attempt to prevent them from industrializing. And those two powers are Germany and Russia. They sign what's called the Treaty of Rapallo. Okay. And most people have never heard of this treaty. It is enormously significant because it's this treaty that makes World War II the bloody affair that it is. Forget about the so-called military contribution of the United States to World War II, folks. That war was won and fought by Russia. When you compare the scale of operations, what the Western allies are contributing to it and what the Russians and the Nazi Germans are putting into World War II are two different things. You're dealing with essentially two superpowers, industrial superpowers, Nazi Germany and Russia. And I know this will probably rankle most Americans listening to it. That's where the war is won and fought. The Treaty of Rapallo made it possible because there were secret codicils in the Treaty of Rapallo insisted upon by Colonel General Hans von Seeckt, Hitler's boss, incidentally, the guy that hired Hitler to go spy on the Nazi party. It's the same general I'm talking about. Hans von Seeckt insisted that the German government put special provisions in that treaty. And basically what those special provisions did is the Germans sold industrial plant, armaments factories, in fact, to the Soviet Union. Okay, in return for the Soviets allowing German military officers to train on Soviet soil far from the prying eyes of the Versailles inspection system that was set up inside of Germany. So you have German generals like Heinz Guderian, inventor of the Blitzkrieg, training in Russia with Marshal Tukhachevsky using heavy artillery and tanks, real stuff, that they are manufacturing for the Soviets in return for this, in return for the training that they get. So in other words, when the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany square off with each other, they're squaring off with officers that trained together and with technology that the Germans helped the Soviets get. So there was an end run by the Germans around the system that the Versailles system tried to put into place. This is exactly, again, you have to understand something here, Daniel. This is how Germany operated after World War I. It's how they operated after World War II. And to my way of thinking, this is what you see them doing now. The moment that Germany is successful in throwing off the British and American thumb, then the world changes for good. They're not quite there yet, but they're getting there.
Yeah, that is a good way to end in that section. What I wanted to ask too, like where I was headed was, when you look at, well, let's circle back to Walter Funk and the term, okay. New World Order, right?
Okay.
And so a lot of the mythos that has grown up around kind of like the Alex Jones New World Order thing, his skull and bones, and you see all these organizations,
which is a German fraternity,
German transplant, yeah. And so that's the point. Like I was reading a history of secret societies, and they went through all of these schools, and they started in the German university system, and so mm-hmm. a lot of English and American, like wealthy, magnates sent their children to Germany to be educated at Heidelberg or any of these universities. And so they went to these clubs, and then they brought that custom back to the United States or back to England. And so they created these networks that were super national, right? So they weren't necessarily loyal to their country, or to an ideal, but they were loyal to their class. And, right. and so they had this incestuous relationship. And so it led to an incestuous economic relationship. I mean, mm-hmm. look at Prescott Bush, and mm-hmm. Brown Brothers Harriman and all these connections between Germany, the United States, England. And that's where I was heading, where
Stalin had the perfect term for these people, because mm-hmm. he was dealing, I wrote my second book on Senator McCarthy, is actually about the link between the Stalinist show trials and McCarthy. Believe it or not, there are links galore with what's going on in all of that. Stalinist referred to Trotsky and his ilk and all of that conspiracy that he was trying to uncover in those show trials, the purge trials. In other words, what I just told you there was Stalin was not making all that stuff up. He made up a lot of it. But remember the old adage, where there's smoke, there's fire, okay? Well, Stalin called that whole group of people rootless cosmopolitans. And, give the man credit where credit is due. That's exactly what they were. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's your secret society, class loyalty, all of that stuff that's at work and has been at work for such a long time in the West. It's right there. And it comes out, in all of this business with Walter Funk, because you can't get. Let's just illustrate this point of this class loyalty a different way. Let's remember that Hitler had to have upper class lessons, how to hold his tea, all of this stuff. And you see him, gradually turning from this rabble rousing, wallpaper hanger into this rather mannered, well-dressed, dapper fellow, to make dictatorship and socialism look acceptable. So yeah, there's your class loyalty.
Well, that's the thing. And this leads us into like the first part of your book is mm-hmm. the background, of the Nazi International and the mm-hmm. evacuation of Nazis and mm-hmm. like Martin Bormann cashing checks in his own name in the 60s in Argentina, Yeah. And so they seem to have been protected by organizations like the CIA, which they helped create. So I wanted you to touch on some of that, like the evacuation of the Nazis after World War II.
To clarify for your listeners, I believe that in addition to the Communist International, we have a Nazi International. That, in other words, that there's an extraterritorial state of fascists and Nazis, essentially. And it's international in scope, and it's extraordinarily powerful. If you don't think it exists, just look at the fact we have a camera on every stoplight in this country. What happens at the end of the war is that Martin Bormann, Hitler's Aminoff's Grease, for want of a better expression for him. Martin Bormann sets up a strategic evacuation plan to get as much loot and technology and personnel out of Nazi Germany as he can, in order to have that network be part of the rebuilding of Germany after the war, and part of a plan whereby Germany becomes the center of a European Union. And again, you know, we're back to that World War II plan. What happens is that he is able to get a lot of personnel, a lot, and I mean a huge amount of money out of Nazi Germany, some of which the Allies recover in the post-war period and some of which they don't. But the most important thing that he gets out of Nazi Germany is a talent pool, some of which goes to the United States, some of which goes to Latin America, some of which goes to Indonesia, some of which goes to Taiwan, and on we could go. Now, what this means is that these Nazis continue to remain in communication with each other after the war. So you can forget about the idea that they're working for us. No, what they're doing is they're having us, the American taxpayer, pay for their continued research. That's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you can tell that they're also setting up the Cold War in a very clever way, because they're seeing to it that the Soviets get all the middle echelon managers, draftsmen, bureaucrats, and so on, that can reconstruct the document trail for all of those wartime, you know, secret projects that the Nazis have got going. Well, the Soviets get the vast amount of those people. We, in the United States primarily, but to a lesser extent Canada and Great Britain, we get the big names. We get the Wernher von Brauns. We get the Hubertus Strugholz, you know, the space medicine guy. We get the Artur Rudolphs, who designed the Saturn V moon rocket, you know, for us, and all of these people. So we get the big names. So in other words, they very neatly divided the spoils prior to the end of World War II, so that both the United States and the Soviet Union, you know, can be constantly fighting each other. And on top of that, and I'm almost done, on top of that, towards the end of the war, they have General Reinhard Gehlen.
I was going to go there. Gehlenorg.
Gehlenorg. General Reinhard Gehlen is the chief of Nazi military intelligence on the Eastern Front. He's the head of an organization called Fremde Heere Ost, Foreign Armies East, okay? And Gehlen approaches the American General Siebert toward the end of the war. In other words, the fighting is still going on, and this Nazi general is making deals with American generals, and ultimately Allen Dulles, of course, to turn over the entire Nazi foreign intelligence, military intelligence network in the Eastern Front. And folks, that doesn't mean just a bunch of people behind Soviet lines. This means people deeply embedded in the entire Soviet Union, in the structure of their military intelligence. He offers to turn this entire network over to American intelligence. And the only requirement that he has is, yeah, we'll work for you. You fund us. We'll continue spying on the Russians for you. But should there ever be a conflict of interest between the United States and Germany, it's understood by you, the Americans, that we will look out for German interests first. And guess what? We bought the deal. So that by 1948, you have a Nazi general and his military intelligence operation spying on the Soviets, doing military preparedness assessments for the CIA, which oftentimes simply types them up on CIA stationery without comment, criticism, or any other editorial interjection, and passes it along to President Truman. So we've got a Nazi general briefing the American president on Soviet intentions. There's something wrong with that picture.
Well, one of the things I wanted to you made me think of Herbert Spencer, right? In 1873, right. Herbert Spencer in Study of Sociology, he talks about how war changes the institutions inside of a country. And World War II profoundly changed the institutions inside of America with a lot of, like what you said, like Nazi institutional structures that were grafted from Germany. Like right now we're living in a Stasi Eastern, you know, German state in many ways. Like the CIA was one, NASA was another one, like all these institutional structures, and countries are not run by personalities. Countries are run by institutional structures. Right. So you did see kind of like a parasitical grafting on of the United States and a fundamental change of us from a republic into a security state.
Yep. So. Yep, absolutely. And I would aver that the Roosevelt administration, which was basically forced into doing this, that the fatal flaw with the American deep state became when it made that deal with the Nazis, because you cannot import their thinking about science and so on without importing their entire ideology about culture, about the organization of society, about political structure and so on. So in other words, this Nazi international group is extraordinarily powerful, but it's also a power which, like the Nazi state itself, is extraordinarily corrupt. It's concentrated into relatively few hands, and those hands are always fighting each other and creating extraordinary waste. This country resembles in its structure, this country far more resembles Nazi Germany than it does Soviet Russia.
In this respect. Or the original republic.
And by far, it doesn't resemble that, you know, other than very tenuously. I'm an anti-federalist. Had I been alive during the constitutional coup, I mean the constitutional convention, I would have been a supporter of Patrick Henry and Elbridge Gerry and people like that.
Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, exactly.
Sam Adams.
Yeah, I'm not at all on the Alexander Hamilton side of things. So yeah, you know, it is it is an enormously influential organization, and there is modern testimony to this effect. When you see so-called neo-Nazi groups in the Ukraine armed and fighting and openly displaying their World War II Waffen SS symbols.
This struck me as Gehlenorg, like all over. Like
once again, you're seeing. Of course it is. Exactly what it is.
But here's what I wanted to ask you. We mentioned.
Let me interrupt and before you ask your question. Let's go back to the reunification of Germany, which was really an Anschluss of East Germany by West Germany. That's really what it was. You know, the East Germans were, you know, we need to reform this system, but, you know, they weren't protesting to join West Germany. If you read what happened, Helmut Kohl used German intelligence to drive that. And he also made a par value swap for the East German Deutschmark. And at that point, it was all over. So in other words, that was the Gehlenorg that drove even that. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to dig into Gehlenorg activities, remember that the Hunts and the Murchisons intelligence group, you know, the Texas oilmen that were implicated in the assassination of President Kennedy, their intelligence group turns out to be the Bundesnachrichtendienst. That's where they're getting their info from. In other words, the Gehlenorg.
Yeah, I saw that before. I read about that, like a lot of that, the Texas connection. What I wanted to circle back to was we're talking about the geographical pivot of history by Halford Mackinder. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, two things that I wanted to hit, but I'll hit one first. he talks about, okay, historically, the trajectory was this, that civilizations were what they call hydraulic societies, right? They were built on mm-hmm. rivers, the largest mm-hmm. ones. Sumeria was built on the Tigris-Euphrates, Egypt right. with the Nile, China with the Yellow River, et cetera. And so naval power was the first power until yes. the Indo-Europeans domesticate the horse. And when right. the Indo-Europeans domesticate the horse, suddenly now you're freed from the rivers, you're freed from geography. And now you have these tribes that were controlling the Silk Road from, you know, Anatolia all the way into China. They controlled Bingo. It for thousands of years. So the geopolitical shifted from hydraulic societies to this land-based power. Then mm-hmm. it went back to the hydraulic societies when the mm-hmm. Muslims took over the Silk Road. They cut out the Christians. Christians mm-hmm. couldn't go over. So Columbus decides to sail to the Americas. Mm-hmm. And now, boom, now we're back to naval power being the, mm-hmm. the world's main power. And so they're trying to stop it shifting again back to Central mm-hmm. Asia with a new Silk Road. But here's the thing. Catherine Austin Fitz makes a really good point. She talks about the new naval trade lanes are going to be satellites out in space. And so you look at the Nazis with the rocket technology, with this is entirely their model. So mm-hmm. it's really interesting that whether the Eurasian landmass takes off or not, they have that circuit breaker where, mm-hmm. okay, well, you don't want to do naval power. Let's do space supremacy. Power. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you see Trump right on cue doing Space Force, which everybody was so excited about, but really this is part and parcel of that model of yes. space being the new trade lanes.
Yes, absolutely it is. And the bad news is that Russia and China know this, mm-hmm. as do the other nations that are part of BRICS. Brazil knows it, India knows it, Japan knows it. So in other words, we are facing an era in which space is going to become, by dint of the changes in technology, as you say, space is going to become the new high ground. So in other words, forget all this rosy pie in the sky stuff that we can't weaponize space. Space is going to be weaponized, folks. No two ways about it. We can let the Russians and Chinese and so on get there first, or we can. The bad problem is they have created more stable cultural structures than we have. And the other thing that people have to get out of their heads is that Russia is some sort of neo-communist or neo-Stalinist state. It is not. It's the first post-modernist state. They're going back to their culture and their traditions in a major way in Russia. And if we don't appreciate that, we are not going to come out on top of this. We cannot bomb our way to success in this one. We have to understand the mentality of Russia. And if we do, there's a chance, because I don't see Russian and Chinese interests as being over the long term compatible. I really don't. Ours might be with the Russians if we can get it out of our thick heads that they are always meant to be our nemesis and our enemy. I don't think this is the case. We need to remember an important lesson about Russia. It was during the American Civil War that the Russians prevented that war from turning into the First World War. And they did that by sending their fleet to the Union and making sure that France and Britain understood that if they intervened in the war, so would Russia.
Yeah, Russia also helped in the Revolutionary War too.
Absolutely.
I remember reading that in Charles Beard's History of the United States.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, and that's the thing too. You don't want, like there are forces that do not want peace between the United States and Russia. And you saw them
of course.
The Trump administration just going ballistic. They yep. want, Hillary Clinton was using all this bellicose language, yep. belligerent language. And it was so unprofessional. I was like, I was looking at this and I was like, how is she talking like this?
Well, yeah, I mean, Russia just sent the I call them Mr. Globaloney, okay, yeah. the Western plutocrats, you know. Russia just sent them a really interesting message. I don't know if you saw it. Russia just sent the Google satellite pictures and latitude longitude coordinates of the European Union headquarters, the Pentagon, and so on and so forth. Now, anybody, including the Russians, can go on and you know, see the satellite pictures of these things and give you the coordinates. So why did the Russians do that? The Russians did it because they're sending the message that we just got done cleaning the Ukraine's clock. We know exactly where you people live. If you want to target us, we can target you.
Well, they did that with the biolabs too.
They did that. They did that with the biolabs. Absolutely. And they did it all without nukes. So, and lo and behold, you know, people have to start learning how to read messages. The message Russia just sent was, look, Mr. Globaloney, if you want to go there, we can go there. Okay. Yeah, and Taiwan just came out and said, oh, by the way, our cruise missiles can reach the Three Gorges Dam.
I saw that on your website. Yeah, exactly.
You talk about sending a message.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're so close to possible. I was worried about, I was reading James Corbett. James Corbett was talking about, he's kind of a skeptic about BRICS, right? So just for our audience.
I am too.
Yeah, it's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And now
lately Argentina.
Yeah, and a bunch of other countries are trying to create this second grid outside of the Atlanticist banking grid that's been in control since World War II, since the Bretton Woods system. And so it looks like there's two different branches of the world, but like we might be shifting out of a unipolar world that happened after 91 when the Soviet Union falls and the United States becomes the hyper superpower. But here's the thing, as Corbett points out, a lot of I didn't know this, that the BRICS was first conceptualized by Jim O'Neill at Goldman Sachs decades ago. And he said that it was originally BRIC, South Africa wasn't included, but he said these four countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, are going to be the four emerging economies. It would behoove them to come together. The person running, the BRICS organization right now is a former like World Bank person. So a lot of the same people who were instrumental in the creation of the BRICS model are interchangeable, like this revolving door with, you know, the Western banking elites. And they wanted to run it through SWIFT, the financial system that China was talking about doing, that they were, you know, they weren't having a separate economic system. It was just piggybacking on the old. So this is my thing. If this is not an organic, you know, kind of break with the Bretton Woods system, if this is not an organic, you know, challenge to American or let's call it a, you know, a globalist, you know, supremacy, then what it really looks like to me is they're creating a second, kind of like we did with the Anglosphere and then the Soviet Union, you know, the first world, and we had the second world, and we had a war. A war, you have to have a second opponent. And that's what it looks like it's shaping up to me.
That is exactly what's going on. The only difference is they are no longer talking about piggybacking all of this on the SWIFT system. Okay, and I'll tell you why. If you're facing a threat external to the planet, you need to have redundancy built into your financial clearing system. You need to have several in place. And they need to be in place in such a way that financial clearing occurs not only through satellite link, but through underground and underwater cable link. This is precisely what's going on. The other thing that's going on is you need a redundancy built into reserve currencies. In other words, you cannot run the world on a currency. You have to have regional reserve currencies. And that's exactly, you'll notice that they chose Argentina to convey that message. Argentina has now just come out and said, oh, we want to join BRICS and we may need some regional currencies. And notably, Argentina did not start talking about central bank digital currency, which I think is an interesting little spin to take notice of, because they have been touting digital currencies for the last 2 years. All of a sudden, it's kind of, we're not so keen on that idea. I think you're going to end up, like I say, the BRICS nations themselves, I think Russia and China's interests over the long term diverge. For the short and midterm, they're together. the two countries that have long-term interests that could converge very easily, and I've been arguing this for a very long time, are Russia and Japan. Japan is Russia's counterweight to China, to being dominated by China, because Japan has the money. Japan has the same technological infrastructure to build out all those high-speed rails for Russia. And unlike China, Japan has actually been sending teams to Russia to investigate and inspect the track system of the Trans-Siberian Railroad. So in other words, Japan and Russia have already been making very, very quiet diplomatic overtures to each other. And you're going to see that increase. The other thing to notice is that Japan and India just signed a few months ago a military logistics assistance pact.
Interesting.
Yeah, most people don't know that they did that, but they have pledged to support each other should they need to do it. Guess what, folks? I don't think the U.S. dollar is even mentioned as the financial clearing mechanism should Wow. India and Japan try to clear accounts. No, this is all being done on a yen rupee basis. Forget you. And the reason why, Daniel, is America has proven itself to be an absolutely untrustworthy ally.
Yeah, especially recently turning people's especially money
recently.
Off.
Yeah.
I mean, that they totally discredited themselves. I wanted to point out just to at the very beginning of our conversation, I mentioned Pepe Escobar, the Brazilian journalist. And one of the right. things he brought to my attention that I found interesting that I'd never thought about in our discussions of the new Silk Road, whether it's the original Silk Road that the Indo-European tribes created thousands of years ago, or the second iteration that China's talking about creating. Mm-hmm. He pointed out that Germany tried to create a version of the Silk Road when Hitler had his pact with Hirohito, you know, he wanted to control that same corridor, and that was not allowed. So all
well,
of a sudden,
here's what most people don't know: inside of Nazi Germany, in the lead up to Japan joining the Axis formally, there were Germans who were much more interested in having Germany support the Kuomintang government of Chiang Kai-shek. So in other words, Germany was definitely thinking in these, you know, modern Silk Road terms. They were just trying to figure out, which horse do we back?
That's do a good pun. Horse do we back?
Which horse do we back? Yeah, exactly. You know, it would be an interesting what if to figure out, you know, what might have happened had Nazi Germany all of a sudden decided to back the Kuomintang, you know, inside of China. You know, would that whole thing have gone differently? So,
well, even discussions, I mean, the Aryan Omania that started in France in the 19th century, it was the Aryan tribes who ran the Silk Road. The Nazis were very conscious of this. Like they were doing Tikarian digs, one of the Aryan tribes, the Tikarians in the 1920s in Western China, Xinjiang. You know, tall blonde mummies that were found in China, and they were running the Silk Road. You know, they're described by Herodotus, these tribes, the Gelonis, you know, tribes, the Scythians, the Sarmatians. So that was part of that mythos. Their mythos was that our natural habitat would be that the steppes across Central Asia, that Europe doesn't stop at Russia. Europe originally went all the way into Siberia before about 3,000 years ago, before the Mongols pushed in and took over all that territory. And they, you know, so that would have been a logical step for them, you know, Lebensraum, but also those raw materials and access to those massive populations.
Well, this is precisely the thinking of Ivan IV in Russia, the collection of the Russian lands. In other words, the whole Russian expansion across Siberia was based on the same sort of thinking that, you know, this is all Europe. And in order to forestall another Mongol-type invasion and extend Christian civilization, Russia has to collect all of those lands. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, it's part of Russian thinking, too. It's not just part of German thinking. It's very much a part of Russian thinking. And the other precursor to all of this is that during the late 19th century, you had serious proposals. Actually, Kaiser Wilhelm II was one of the people proposing it, that the three emperors, the Russian Tsar and the Austrian Emperor and the German Emperor, get together and create what was called the Drei Kaiserbund, the Three Emperors League, having the three crowned heads of, look what you have, crowned head of the Eastern Orthodox, crowned head of the Roman Catholics, and crowned head of the Protestants, joining in a league basically to ensure that their dominance of the Eurasian landmass continued. And again, if you dig and scratch, you find Perfide Albion ruining that little thing through some careful skullduggery, diplomacy, and intelligence, you know, covert ops. And I think really it's the failure of the Three Emperors League to get off the ground that cements Germany's fate, you know, that the British decide we're going to encircle Germany and get rid of that problem. You know, well, good luck, Britain.
I'm going to start wrapping this up, and I'm going to ask you, like, going forward, right? So we've laid the groundwork, you know, the going all the way back to the Indo-Europeans, to the present, and to the space age, to the, you know, the battle for space as the new naval trade lanes. So what would be like some high octane speculations going forward? You know, what do you see happening?
Well, I think the United States will have a kind of a Marcus Aurelius Renaissance before the final collapse. But I do think we are an empire in the process of collapse. We might be able to forestall it for a period of time, but I don't see it continuing in anything like its current shape without a massive waking up on the part of the American people in an good old anti-federalist direction. We may be seeing the beginnings of that now. I don't know. But that's the only thing I think as a cultural and political assessment can save the country.
No, that's brilliant. I've come to the same conclusion myself. There were only two times in history that I know of that a moral revolution brought a country back from the brink. And one was in the Byzantine Empire, and it added an additional 400 years. And one was China under Confucius. Right. And he went around and he was a moral revolutionary. Like Jesus Christ himself was a moral revolutionary. Right. Right. And we remember these people. We don't remember the political leaders at the time. It was much larger of a social force, you know, when that happened. So if that can be brought about, then yeah, I mean, what would the famous quote by John Adams, you know, our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people. It is wholly unequal to the government of any other. So for us to get back to those roots, you know, something very serious would have to happen. I'm doing that. I just started a second show called Actionable Ethics, where I talk about ethics, and I'm trying to, I'm not Confucius, obviously. I'm confused many times, but I'm trying to get that conversation started.
Yeah. It's the conversation that needs to start. And we have to understand that we are not going to be able to restore our freedom until we understand that it has been basically subverted by the plutocratic banking class. They're at the heart of this. And we have to understand that what's good for Wall Street is not necessarily good for America. There's not a corporate charter in this country that has the Bill of Rights as part of its corporate charter, and that's the problem. But beyond that, I don't think, you know, I am not optimistic about the long-term future of the country unless there is such a massive moral and cultural and spiritual revolution. It's going to have to be on the order of what happened in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and I don't see that happening yet. As far as Europe is concerned, I think eventually, given the way that this country is being viewed and has behaved, if I were an American ally, you know, a powerful American ally like a Great Britain or a France, I'd look at this and say, enough of you people. We're going our own way. Enough is enough. And I see Japan, you know, I saw Japan starting to do that in a major way under Shinzo Abe before he retired. I think Japan is also the other country to watch. because behind all of this talk about from Chancellor Schultz in Germany and Premier Kishida in Japan, behind all of this talk of rearming, you know, to carry our share of the burden, what they're really saying is we're done relying on the Americans. And I don't blame them, quite frankly. I do not blame these countries for just being fed up with this country. I don't blame the Russians for being fed up. You know, the Russians have a word for modern America, and it's a big, long Russian word that basically translates not agreement capable. In other words, we're a bunch of children. And, you know, if we start losing the game, then we just change the rules or, you know, throw the table up and, you know, that's what we are. And the rest of the world is starting to treat us that way. So we better clean up our game.
Yeah.
You know, we have to. This business of being, you know, the big bad bully and policeman, and you agree with us, or we're going to sanction you or cancel, you know, we see it in domestic policy in this country from the people running the country, that if you don't agree with them, we're going to pout and, you know, burn things down, burn down Catholic churches and blah, 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 because we don't get our way. And we're seeing domestically what we are internationally. So this whole political class that's been leading the country, it has to go. Otherwise, yeah, well, we're in bad shape.
Well, in The Wealth of Nations, you know, Adam Smith, he talks about at the end of chapter 11, he says that there are three groups in a society, and like three basic groups. He said one group is people who make money through wages. And he said their fate rises or falls with the fate of the country. So as the country does well, they do well. Another group is real estate. So as the country does well, they do well. He said there's a third group, however, and this is international finance. As the country collapses, they do well. And he warned you, never let this third class get in charge of your legislation, because it'll be in their economic interest, like a hedge fund, to collapse you and sell you for scrap. And disastrously, America, since the post-World War II period, and you know, I consider myself, you know, on the conservative side. I no longer do. I consider myself, I don't want to conserve this. You know, I don't want to conserve Lindsey Graham and Biden.
No,
you know.
No. I tell people I'm a traditionalist.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm not a conservative. You know, enough Lindsey Graham, enough Mitch McConnell.
Yeah. And the conservative thing for since World War II, since 1947, principally, it's a hallmark year for you. They basically have been, you know, what's good for GM is good for America. You know, what's good for, you know, the plutocrats is good for America. What's good for international finance is good for America. And now we're watching our country hollowed out. We're watching it morally, you know, collapse. Yep. We're watching it economically be strip mined.
Yep.
And so people are waking up and they're starting to realize, wait, that federal layer is basically created by the bankers and financiers to as a circuit breaker to short circuit the states. And who are the states? The states is the actual country. So we have this banker graft over top of the actual country that's designed to, like, you know, take away the people's power. But with that, I'm going to thank Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Thank you for having me.
It was awesome having you on here, Dr. Farrell. And you can find his book, The Nazi International, at any finer bookstore on the internet, retailers like Amazon.com and stuff. His website is GizaDeathStar.com. And I would join any thinking person to go and follow his work. And thanks again, Joseph. You're the best, man.
Yep, thank you.